get a mantra of how you want to be all day every day and just meditate on that mantra. And then it's hard to keep it going all day long. It's good to do a 1 minute three times a day. And if you want to go 10 or an hour or whatever, that's fine and that's great. But if you do the 1 minute, you're already working towards being a better person because you're setting the intention and digesting it and saying it to yourself over and over, how you want to be, how you want to contribute, how you want to be thought, how you want to be seen. We all just want to be loved, so love is the answer.
Okay, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery Podcast. I'm Michael Gervais, and by trade and training, a sport and performance psychologist, as well as the co-founder of Compete to Create. And the whole idea behind these conversations is to learn in an applied way from people who have dedicated their life's efforts towards mastery. And we want to double click and understand, how do they organize their inner life? How do they make sense of themselves and the world and events around them? And then how do they use their mind to build and refine their craft? And then we also want to double click and understand, what are they searching for? And when they reach obstacles or they have internal setbacks, how do they manage that process to stay forward, to live with passion, and to be able to persevere towards that vision, that thing that they're searching for? Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time in early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing, it just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA.
Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Now, this week's conversation is with Garrett McNamara, and he's an international big wave explorer known for discovering and pioneering and surfing the biggest wave in the world. And it's known as the Everest of the Oceans, Nazaré, Portugal. And if you haven't seen this wave yet, do a search online and look for just Nazaré, N-A-Z-A-R-E, and surf. And it's just an extraordinary wave. I mean, it's amazing. It's this amazing convergence that takes place right at this tip at Portugal. And so Garrett, you know, he's amazing. He's received the Vasco da Gama Medal of Honor from the Portuguese Navy for his contributions to Portugal. So he really did something very special for this unique wave that he found, basically, and was one of the first to surf it. He currently lives between Portugal and Hawaii with his family, where he and his wife run the McNamara Foundation. It's a nonprofit organization focused on providing children meaningful nature experiences. You know, what they're doing is they're trying to teach people to become lifelong stewards of the earth. And in this conversation, Garrett shares some incredible stories. I mean, wait until we get into this, about his upbringing, which all of it helps make sense of how he became to be the man he is today, which literally is a pioneer in high consequence environments and absolutely fascinated with the ocean and human potential. And Garrett, flat out in the surf world amongst his peers, is known for being a pioneer, but also deeper than that, for being a master of his craft. And I also want to mention that nobody gets to the places that people like Garrett get to without a deep commitment towards mastery of craft and mastery of self. And that's where the psychological skills play part. And that's why Coach Carroll, the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks, that's why the two of us fired up Compete to Create, which, if you're inspired to train your mind in the same way that help world-class athletes do what they do, that's allowed Garrett, for example, to drop into 80-foot mountain of waves, then, you know, we've set that course up, and hopefully it scratches that itch for you. And quick little rundown, over the course of 8 weeks, what we do is we pull back the curtain and show you how world-class athletes and performers train their mind and organize their inner life so that you can apply those same skills in your own life. And the end game is to flourish. That's it. By conditioning your mind to live in the present moment more often. The present moment, it's the only place where performance is expressed and wisdom revealed. So the entire program is dedicated to show you how. How do we do that? And so if you're interested, I hope you are, punch over to competetocreate.net/findingmastery. And because you are a Finding Mastery listener, you get a $50 discount for your purchase. Again, competetocreate.net/findingmastery. So with that, let's jump right into this week's conversation with the legend, Garrett McNamara. Garrett, how are you?
I'm good. I'm like looking at your dog. Look at that guy. He's like a little human. He's a human in a dog suit.
Really? Australian Labradoodle. I mean, they really are sweet, kind dogs.
So yeah. Labradoodle Shepherd, how's that work?
Australian Labradoodle. And I don't know if it means they're from Australia or it's like
some Australian Shepherd in it.
Yeah, maybe. Like, I'm not quite sure.
Because they do have Shepherd Doodles or whatever.
Oh, they do.
Yeah. But
yeah. Yeah. So he's with us today. Okay. So let's do this. Where did you come from?
Came from my mommy. I was born in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and we just were there until I was about one, and then moved to Berkeley, California during it's very liberal and a lot of uprising and People's Park riots going on, and we got there right as that riot was ending.
What year
drove
was it?
Right in. It was like 69, 60. Yeah, 68, 69.
Okay. And then how old were you when you moved out to California?
1.5.
Okay, so right away.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you feel, are your roots in California or do you feel your roots are in Massachusetts?
More in Hawaii. But main roots from the beginning, yeah, California, definitely. That's what molded the beginning of my life.
Why did mom and dad move from Massachusetts to California?
Well, when I was 1.5, we were living at a boarding school where my dad was the Latin teacher, English major, and basketball coach, and my mother was the house mother. And they actually found me a mile away from home when I was about 1.5, getting ready to walk down the dirt road, getting ready to walk on the highway in my diaper. And so I guess I was an explorer from the beginning, just wanted to explore. And my mom was preoccupied, to say the least, so I could get away. She said I was an escape artist, but I think she didn't really pay attention to where I was.
Okay, that's alarming. Because why is that? Looking back, like, what was she distracted by?
She just really caught up in whatever she's doing. And it seemed like, she was more of a, she said, God raised us. She said, yeah, I just let you guys go. And God raised you. So,
wow.
And I remember from a very young age, I could do whatever I wanted at any time of the day or night.
So then how did you learn consequences? How'd you learn stuff? Like, what were the consequences that?
We just went out and did everything, and that's how we learn, from experience. In Berkeley, it was pretty crazy. We were free. I mean, we would go to school, get dropped off at the front door, and we'd walk out the back. We'd go to UC Berkeley, and this is elementary school. We'd cut every single day. And if my dad found us, he'd bring us back to the front door and we'd walk out the back.
Your whole life for being able to manage like counterculture, off access, risk taking, dangerous environments, because you've been pushing up against rules and boundaries since 1.5, maybe.
I guess like unintentionally, yeah, naturally just having fun. That was basically, we were just having fun. We were just kids having fun. We had 2 stepbrothers and they were our best friends. We introduced my dad and their mom and that was it. And then we lived together and we were out of control. We would, in Berkeley, you got all these apartment buildings where all these college kids lived and we'd climb the fire escapes. And this is like 9 years old, steal all the marijuana plants, take them home, roll fat joints. It was out of control.
At 9 years old?
Yes.
Come on.
It was out of control. We'd get this big black the black trash bags full of me coming down the fire escape on our BMX bikes. It was amazing. We had so much fun.
So if you want to raise one of the most dynamic big wave surfers on the planet ever, have no rules.
Well, I don't know. I don't think that works because I'm not the most dynamic guy, but no rules work for me.
So I know you're going to, you know, use the humble card, but you have a massive dent. You've made a massive impact in big wave surfing. And like, what are some of the records? I think largest wave at Nazaree for sure, right?
Yeah, I got super lucky my whole career. But I mean, I do believe luck is when preparation meets opportunity and you just got to grab it when it's coming by or it'll pass you by. And I always had kind of a mission, always was focused on some type of monumental feat on the big sessions that we had. I had to focus on one a year just to put food on the table. And so it was pretty amazing. Since 2003, we got to do the Jaws Towing World Cup when I quit surfing. At 30 years old, I quit. I gave up on my passion. I was opened a store. I figured that was the right thing to do for my future, for my kids, so I could, you know, keep food on the table. The surfing career, once you're 30, just usually over, maybe even before that. And then I was driving just to work and looking at my favorite wave, perfect. And I never drank coffee in 30. I started drinking coffee, getting depressed at the desk, doing the, you know, check in the drawer, making sure we made some money that day and trying to get customers to come in and show them my cool picture and talk about how great the store is. And it was doing good. The store was good, but I was depressed. And I remember driving by Lonnie's, like, perfect. And I'm like, what, I got to get back in the water. And I went to the store, and I had this book, Business Plan for Dummies. It was the first time I ever wrote a real business plan, and I did that for the store. And so I said, well, let's try that for surfing. So I said, okay, goal, keep surfing. How do I do that? Okay, win the eddy and win the jaws. Okay, and then I train and eat right and focus, manifest. And I had that on my bathroom mirror, on the refrigerator, in the car, and everywhere I went every day, I focused on the goal. And I realized that every second I took from the goal focus, from the roadmap, it would take me longer to get to achieve. And it was super interesting. The eddy and the jaws end up happening on the same day. And I'm 4 a.m. just freaking back then you got to call to check the buoys to see what the waves are doing. So every hour it changes. I'm called every hour all night long. And I have my partner waiting for me on Maui, Rodrigo Resende.
So just a level set, jaws is one of the heaviest waves in the world. It's on Maui, only breaks when it's massive. The eddy is the occasional, it's not guaranteed that it's going to run, but it's the international invitation where people from all over the world come in for this large wave event to honor Eddie Aikau, right? And Waimea Bay. And so you've got a heavy wave, and then you've got this, not that Waimea is not heavy, but you've got a really powerful cultural experience in surfing, you know, that the Eddie offers. So those were your two big ones. And you thought, if I win both of those,
well, I didn't think they both happened the same day. I was just, you know what? I wasn't focused on winning. I guess I was. Yeah, I was focused on winning both of them. But like you said, the Eddie is the most prestigious, most memorable, so special, with a few friends in the water surfing in honor of Eddie Aikau, the epitome of the Aloha spirit, the just like most selfless person, gave his life trying to rescue everybody. And I had surfed it the year before. I was like seventh alternate.
So you got to get invited.
Yeah.
So at this point,
the seventh alternate.
Seventh alternate. So you didn't even make the cut list. And you're age 30 something at this point. Is that right?
Yeah, 32, 33.
Can you hear my dog? he's really feeling it right now. Okay.
So,
Go back to, actually, you know, let's do this. How did you get to Hawaii?
Got to Hawaii.
From Berkeley to Hawaii.
We were in Berkeley for about a couple months while my mom wrangled up a bunch of people to start a hippie commune.
Mom's out there now.
Well, she's looking for herself first. She's trying to find herself. So she figured a hippie commune was it. And she got my dad and made pretty much forced him to come along. And he was happy. He's pretty content. And he's, you know, he was his teacher. And she said, okay, we're going to Berkeley. We're going to start a hippie commune. He inherited a bunch of money. So they were cruising.
How much?
And like, I don't know.
Like
I probably
big
wasn't,
time or
it,
like
probably
enough to
like
get
a
by?
couple hundred thousand, which was a couple million back then.
Wow. And that was from her mom? Or dad?
I don't know. It's a good question. I got to ask her.
Well,
it was from her mom. From her dad.
And I'm just trying to get a sense, like it was enough to kind of get by or enough like living got dramatically changed?
The living, I don't know. So I was 1.5, so I have no idea. But we just did whatever she wanted, so it worked. But I remember we always had to get to the bank to get the next payment when we were in Mexico. And
so then you moved to Mexico.
Well, she did the commune and we got 30 people in a house all together, all just amazing, so fun, all running around naked. I wrote a book. It's called Hound of the Sea. It's a memoir. And I was talking to the publisher and my wife. I'm like, I remember as a kid was running around naked through the fields eating watermelon. And then I'd always look down and I'd see watermelon seeds all over. So I'm like, I want to scribble a little boy in the field with watermelon seeds all over, and I want to call it Watermelon Seeds on My Ding Dong. That's the title of the book, but it got vetoed.
I don't understand.
Oh, and I figured that would, and put the little boy on the cover, you know, a little scribble.
Dude, okay, hold on.
You could put seeds all the way on his belly and put a black spot over it if you have to, but let's go all the way. Let's get some people interested in this book.
Listen, I got to say this. So I've known your body of work and who you are from being in the surf community, and you're a legend by reputation and by what I've seen. And everyone I know in Big Wave and also on tour or whatever has said, you don't know Garrett yet? You got to meet him. You got to meet him. Wow. You got to meet him. So how about it? Okay. All right. So I didn't realize you had this colorful. And let me get it right. Massachusetts, California, mom builds a commune. Then Mexico for a bit. And I think Central America too.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And there's a little heavy period there, I think.
Yep. If
I
don't have. Well, you read the book, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Hawaii.
Yeah.
Okay. Walk us through that narrative. And the reason is to set the context. Like, how does somebody who is world-class at risk-taking in consequential environments, how do you cut your teeth? And there's lots of ways. But so this is like your way. So let's go from hippie commune. How does that blow up?
Okay, so we're at the hippie commune having the time of our life. And there's like 30 people on 44 acres in one house. And then everybody started getting their own houses. And my mom didn't really like that. She wanted everybody together. And for some reason, she didn't find herself there. So she wanted to keep hunting. And she told my dad, let's go travel to Mexico in a Volkswagen van. My dad was happy. He didn't want to keep going. He's like, I'm good. I'll stay. You want to go, you go. And my mom took me and left my brother, my father, and we jumped in a Volkswagen van. I remember it was kind of red, rusty, with Mad Bob and his two daughters. And we drove from Sonoma County, Casadero, to British Honduras and stopped at beaches, and the van broke down every few hundred miles, and I was like five or something, somewhere around there, and I knew how to fix everything on the van. By the time we got to Honduras, I knew any sound of anything, and I knew how to fix it and what it was going to be and how, where we had to find parts, and it was pretty amazing. We ended up in British Honduras, where we actually were in a traveling circus for a little while. It was crazy. And my mom dropped me off with this Mexican family. We went there and they took us in and fed us, and we hung out for a day or two. And then my mom had to do her normal routine to go to the bank to get the money, or I don't know what she was actually doing. And she left me with this Mexican family for about 2 weeks. And it was awesome. We had horses and cows and chickens, a big ranch, and I was in heaven. I was like, wow, this is nice. And stability, you know, kind of good family. And then here comes mom driving back in the Volkswagen van. I don't know, I was happy to see my mom, but I kind of feel like I was kind of didn't want to leave because it was so stable and nice. And then we went to British Honduras, where she met this pretty crazy Mexican guy who was really abusive. And that's the only part of my childhood that I really blocked out, that I don't remember any of it.
The abuse?
Yeah. She said she explained it in detail and it did not sound good. So I definitely blocked it out.
And so were you abused or mom abused?
My mom, I don't think I was at all. I don't ever remember being abused at all.
What period of time? Like, was that how old?
Five, six, somewhere around there, maybe seven at the oldest.
And how long did it last?
John, I don't think we were there for more than a couple months, and maybe six at the most. But then I would go back to Berkeley. Liam would come, or she would alternate or keep us together. But I think she liked to leave at least one of us with our dad, just because he was probably really sad about everything.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to Hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's Hydro.com, Hydrow.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you go check them out. Okay, so when I'm listening, I'm hearing like wild adventure, borderless, boundaryless type of behaviors and principles. And then I also hear incredible freedom and incredible dysfunction. You know, I'm imagining drug use. I'm imagining, you know, that there's as much experimentation that humans can have, you know, running naked. I don't know if that was you or others.
Everybody.
Yeah. So, okay.
We had sweat lodges with peyote. I ate peyote when I was like 4.
Come on.
Yeah. Our friends owned Ghirardelli Chocolate in San Francisco. And they would come up for the parties because we had all these scientists and these psychiatrists, and we had all these amazing, just super intelligent people on the commune with us. And it drew a lot of people in from San Francisco to come for the weekend. And we had this lake, this pond with a sweat lodge. And I remember they came up with all these bags of chocolate and big watermelons, and where they're all, the adults are all getting ready to do their sweat, and the kids are all just, we were kids just having a blast. And the peyote went around, and I remember all, or the kids, older kids, they would always like make us do whatever they wanted. So they gave us peyote and we ate it. I remember eating some peyote, a button, the straight button, and then throwing up the biggest watermelon chocolate fountain you ever saw.
Oh my God, no.
And I remember that clear as day. I don't remember the trip, but I've taken peyote afterwards, and it's not that heavy of a trip. So, I mean, I guess it matters how much you take, because Jim Morrison, he's just going out there when he was taking it, but he probably was taking some other things too. I don't know.
So what is drug use for you? What has your drug history been as a...
surfing, we tried. We really had a lot of fun when we were young, and then it can get ugly if you don't if you keep going, and luckily I'm stopped and don't do any drugs. And
are you a user, abuser, or addict during that time?
User, abuser, or addict. Probably all three at one time.
So the addict is like, I really can't stop.
Yeah, I got to there for a bit where I was just never going to do it again. And then you do it again. And then never going to do it again. And you do it again. It's really fun in the beginning. And then it can get really ugly and get a hold of you and won't let you go.
What does ugly mean?
Ugly is, you know, just driving by perfect waves, going to get drugs instead of going surfing.
Yeah. So that was the primary choice. And was it a numbing experience for you? A distraction? A way to hide some of the pain? Was it to have fun?
In the North Shore, you have 6 months of really good, awesome waves. And then you have 6 months of nothing. I think it's kind of trying to keep the rush going for fun.
Yeah, there you go.
And
yeah.
It was... We hung out with older people from when we were really young, and we could there. I mean, everybody was just like, yeah, we just mainly smoked a lot of pot, but then coke got pretty, came into the picture, and that was when it got a little bit ugly. Definitely got ugly.
When you talk about it, like, is there pain behind this, or are you like matter of fact about it? It's hard for me to actually feel what's
there's
happening.
There's no pain, but I just think about what other, like, you know, to be honest, with sponsors and stuff is the only thing that kind of comes to mind that I don't want to.
You don't want
them out that
you that know, there was but, this was
personally.
Part
of I'd love to share it all and
yeah,
help people understand and realize that you don't have to be a victim and you don't have to let those things define you, and you there is amazing easy ways to be on track and not making conscious choices. Make conscious choices. Choices to love yourself, and mainly when whatever you're putting in your body, make sure it's loving for yourself.
There you go.
Whether it's information or food or anything, make sure you're loving yourself.
Is that a philosophy that you live by?
You live by it. I'm not the best at it. I work on it every day. I mean, you can meditate in the morning, and I do meditate, and I'm going loving, kind, and helpful. That's my focus, loving, kind, and helpful. First of all, be very loving, kind, and helpful to yourself, and then you can do that with everybody else.
And then when did you adopt that philosophy?
I've been reading Deepak for some years now, and then just had a really amazing retreat with Anna Forrest Yoga, probably the best yoga on the planet. And I've always been very selfless, but unconsciously, just as normal, as a, that's just who I am. But now that I've read some really powerful books that help me really understand how I am and who I am and how I can be, and my wife Nicole definitely was she's solely the reason that I'm so happy and doing so well.
Okay, so was early life
just by her sharing everything with me? And so, you know, women are so in touch with everything and so selfless. And so if you listen when they talk, you can learn a lot.
Okay. All right. Early childhood, middle adulthood, middle adolescence. Was it traumatic or not? Am I putting a label on there that is undue?
For me, it was not traumatic.
It's not
it
a
was
traumatic.
Fun. Amazing. Okay. There was one part of my life
one
that
segment.
Was not fun.
Okay.
Okay, so after the hippie commune and after Mexico and Honduras, my mom dropped us back off with my father. And he had this amazing restaurant in Berkeley and this amazing area. And we had two block street. It's called Emerson. 20 friends. BMX, skateboard all day, every day, baseball team, soccer, football, basketball, everything. But skateboarding and BMX was our favorite, and baseball. But then we had every single baseball card, every football card, every stacks of gum this high from all the baseball cards. And so where were we going?
I was saying traumatic, and you said no fun.
Fun. So yeah. Then mom comes back after about 6 months or a year. I don't know how long it was. And we're like, uh-oh, here she comes. And she's like, she's going to find her God now. I don't think she quite found herself. So now she's got to find God because herself was not what she was looking for. Maybe she had some emptiness or something. She left my dad. That was the biggest mistake she ever made because he was there ready for her, and she just wanted to go find herself and then find God. So she takes us to Mount Shasta, where everybody's looking for aliens and spaceships. You know, that's where they're supposed to be. And I guess a lot of people over there are looking for God as well. Maybe the aliens and God hang out together. So I don't know how it all works, but I'm not sure. So she finds this cult called the Christ family, who somehow resonates with what she's looking for. And they're all looking up. The cult leader is Christ Lightning, Amen, who very elusive, very hard to find. We were always hunting for him. He's in Florida. Okay, let's go to Florida. He's here. He's there. And from Mount Shasta, the laws of the cult are you have to burn everything you own, money included. So there's no sex, no killing, and no materialism are the laws. So all your lively possessions, anything leather, anything made from animals, money, all her inheritance in the fire. Our nice leather boots, the normal boots, but keep your feet warm, in the fire. They gave us a sheet that we cut up like a robe. So we had these Jesus robes, exactly envisioned Jesus. That was us, little Jesuses, with one rolled up blanket that we held on our shoulder and no shoes. And we walked for I don't know how long. And we weren't allowed to hitchhike. But if somebody stopped and wanted to pick us up, we were allowed to take a ride. I think I was like, my brother was... It's not really bad with the whole... I feel like I was 7 and Liam was 5. So it must... Yeah, that sounds right. So Honduras must have been like... 3 and 5, somewhere around there. So some people would pick us up hitchhiking. Not hitchhiking. They'd pick us up. We'd take a ride. They'd take us home, feed us. Those are like the highlights of the whole experience. As we're walking barefoot forever, the people would always yell. We'd be chanting, no sex, no killing, no materialism. And the people would always say, well, where'd the kids come from? My mom was, that was before.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. We'd come up to like a Safeway or what's a big Publix or something back and
supermarket
straight to the dumpster. Heaven, so much food, so good. We would eat out of the dumpsters.
What was your worldview then? I know that you didn't have it formed, but if you look back, what did you think about the world when you were a young kid?
It's like a playground.
Okay. And then when you got into, did you go to school, like high school?
Very rarely.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. You had the back door. So you didn't.
Elementary.
Not at all.
Not at all. I get to Hawaii. They think I'm borderline retarded. And I go to my school, second smartest kid in the class. That shows you how behind Hawaii is in the education system. I couldn't even write my name, I think, like in sixth grade.
How does that work?
Because we never went to school. We didn't learn anything. We learned the streets. We learned street. We knew about the world. We didn't know about book smarts. But then in Hawaii, I went to school a bit, and I liked my teachers. I loved my teachers. My first teacher, Miss Galbiso, was amazing. I loved her. And that's where I was the second smartest in the class, to Oscar Ramosco. And so I was kind of like, okay, this is cool. But it was tough. Once I started surfing, you're going walking down the street to go to school, and you go right to school and you go left to the beach. I went left a lot after. I mean, that was sixth grade. We got to Hawaii, Miss Galbiso.
Is that Pupukea, Pipe?
And that was actually Wailua. We're in the armpit in Cement City.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. My mom, it was crazy. This musician, she tried to get us to Hawaii like three times. Everybody threw us a big going away party, and we never made it. And then the third time, we still thought it wasn't going to happen. But she got this African-American, was her husband. She married him. He's a really good musician. Nice guy. His name was Daryl. And he got the tickets. We're going to the airport. She sewed up these costumes, for lack of a better word. We were in orange velvet pants, white satin shirts with orange velvet vest. It was the Jackson 5 meets the Partridge Family to the airport.
Oh, God.
Yeah. That was like coming back to Berkeley in the Jesus robes to my dad's street where all the kids were. It's all our friends, and we're walking up with Jesus robes, just amazing. Terrified that somebody's going to see us. So the Christ Family wasn't fun. The robes were not fun. She left us with one of the brothers.
Honduras was not fun for that small period, right? Yeah.
No, I don't remember that.
You blocked it out.
Yeah.
Is that because it was so traumatic that you blocked
it out?
Probably. Yeah. Okay. So you have the ability to manage difficult things. Either you block it out or you just roll with it. Somehow you figured things out. And
we're just lucky.
Okay,
Irish.
Did you say Irish?
The Irish.
Are you Irish?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What is your working definition of luck if you take it past the theory that you just mentioned, which is preparation meets opportunity?
I think if you're a good person and you have good intentions, yin and yang, give and you get, especially if you're not expecting anything in return and you're just being selfless and honest and loving and kind, luck will come your way.
Do you have a spiritual framework?
I just recently, I was a Christian back in the day, and I was pretty into it. And I just like, how can any religion say that amazing, beautiful person that's not a Christian is going to hell, or that amazing, beautiful person is not going where everybody else is going? All these different religions have their little, twisted scriptures or whatever they want to call it. So I just like pulled back from all religion, and I always had God as my rock, like, oh, please God, or thank you God. And I thanked him a lot and said please here and there, especially underwater on a big wipeout. But I tend to thank him way more than I ask for help. But anytime I ask for help, it worked. But I believe in the power of manifesting, and I believe in the power of attraction and energy and scientific fact. Everything is connected, and we're all part of one energy. But I didn't know what to call it anymore. I'm like, what is this energy? What is this thing that's created everything? And the great unknown, the creator. But I didn't feel good whenever I, what am I saying? Please, I'm underwater, giant wave on my head, and 30 seconds go by. I'm like, please, papaya, save me. No, I didn't feel right. Please, great unknown. This didn't resonate. And just recently I came to, just call it God. Who cares? It feels good when I call it God. So I'm just going, please, God. God is God. I don't know what he is or who he is. I feel like it's an energy. And if you want to go try and think, oh, yes, there's this God and he created us. And then you go, okay, no, who created God? That's when it gets really weird. And we're not supposed to go there. But I just think everything's energy. I know everything's energy. That's a fact. And if I want to call it God and it feels good, I'll call it God. So I've just decided that actually recently in the last month.
Okay.
Because I wasn't calling to God anymore, and I didn't know what to call this thing that gives me a sense of security. A lot will say a false sense of security. It gives me a sense of security.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. It's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO. apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to aquatrue.com. You spell it AQUATRU.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's aquatrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there.
What are you an explorer of?
Explorer of? I like to explore big waves. Yeah, explore big waves. But I've been exploring a lot more internally. Yeah.
That's why I asked the question, because like the first part of your life was definitely like at the whim of your parents. They were explorers, of searchers, maybe more so than explorer. They were searching for something. And then you found surfing as a way to tap into nature, have some thrill, be part of a community, in a way that you could maybe get good at something, right? Because you can get your arms around it, so to speak. And it sounds like you've been wrestling with the internal side probably your whole life, trying to figure things out using sport, using surfing as a way to contextualize it. So let's get into go back to this this moment in time where you had two big wave events that you're depressed. So you're a good surfer, 30s hit. You're like, I got to put some food on the table for my kids. Why did you not repeat what your parents showed you how to raise kids?
I don't think I consciously didn't. I don't think I consciously focused on doing things that they didn't do. My wife at the time, she had her father and mother were together and seemed pretty stable. She had like 9 brothers and everybody kind of lived together as a family, which was, I thought that was really cool. The society these days tells us we need to separate from our parents and separate from our family and, you know, divide and conquer. So they do a really good job at that. And they all stayed together and everybody looked at, oh, yeah, you guys are living together. I kind of liked it. And I actually really liked it. Maybe it's kind of because of the commune childhood.
So mom didn't quite sacrifice her lifestyle for the kids. You flipped it on its head and said, I'm going to sacrifice myself for the kids. And you went and got a job, found yourself depressed, said, whoa, 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 I can't live life this way. I'm going to start thinking about creating a structure and a path for surfing, success in surfing as well. You find yourself at this crossroad now. Do I pick the Eddie or do I pick Jaws? And which one did you pick?
I picked Jaws because I had a partner waiting on me. But the kicker was the year before I was 7th alternate.
There we go.
And I was the only surfer in history to ever get to paddle out as the 7th alternate because the 7th guy did not show up. And I got out in my heat, ready for the horn to blow, and the 7th guy shows up. I just paddled to the beach. Oh. Devastating. I lived at Waimea Bay. I surfed it more than anybody. I could see it from my front yard. And it was my dream. And it was so devastating, but still I was torn and I was still an alternate. I was like, I don't remember what number, but I was alternate again. Probably climbed the ladder a little more. But I was still torn because it was such a desire to surf in the Eddy and in honor of Eddie.
You made the decision to not do the Eddy, but to go to Jaws. You had a guaranteed spot. Yeah, Jaws.
That was very strategic maneuver. I was with Bad Boy Clothing, who is a Brazilian company. And there was this guy, Rodrigo Rezende, who I at that time felt he was the most focused big wave rider in the world. But he couldn't drive a jet ski. He didn't know how to drive a ski at all.
So this was mid-90s?
It was 2003.
Okay.
He was Brazilian. I was a Brazilian sponsor for the company. So I knew if I had a Brazilian partner, they'd better chance of getting in. And I actually talked to the organizer and he's like, yeah, go with Rodrigo and we'll put you in. So it was strategic, but he was also the gnarliest, best big wave rider. So both strategic. I had the best guy in it, and he's a Brazilian. So we are getting in and we can win. I actually knew we were winning.
Were you on the ski or surfing?
Both.
So partners do both?
The crazy kicker is I went to Jaws about a couple of weeks or a month before, because they called the contest on. We all went over there.
And it's got to be bigger than 25 feet, something like that.
Hawaiian, so 50 foot plus,
yeah.
And it was, the swell didn't come in, and it was shitty wind. But we went out anyway, and it was like 20, 30 foot faces. And he told me in a couple waves, and it was so terrifying. I was like, and it wasn't even big. And I was so afraid of this place after that. I was so scared to Jaws.
Was this the first time you surfed it?
First time.
Oh.
So I'm going to the contest first time. But luckily, we had a warm-up day before, but it wasn't a warm-up. It was like worse than a warm-up. It was a terror. It was like, holy shit. And
describe Jaws to me.
Jaws is this like super dome. There's this really beautiful bay, and it comes out to the north, and there's like this little little perching spot where you can sit up and the whole place, you can see everything, but it gets a little closer on one side. And then it's all rocks on the bottom, it's a super long cliff, like, I don't know, a couple hundred feet. And you got to walk down this muddy, path, and then it's all boulders, huge boulders, and it looks impossible to paddle out. If you time it just right, you can make it without breaking your fins off or ruining your board. I was super lucky. I don't think I've ever paddled out at Jaws. I may have once or twice. I don't remember ever paddling out at Jaws. I've always was on a jet ski or on a boat. And I paddled in at Jaws before. I know I have paddled in because I had to get my boards off the rocks and then come back out. But it's just this amazing, perfect reef. The amazing thing about Jaws is the reef. It's a perfect triangle reef. Swell hits it and just makes this hollow top. The wave stands up perfect and then makes a perfect tube, round cylinder that all the surfers desire, called the barrel. To get in the barrel is the goal and the dream and the happy place. And I actually named my son Barrel. He's 5 and his name's Barrel.
Of course
he's,
you did.
He's ahead of all of us.
Oh man. Yeah,
he's in the barrel all day, every day.
So when I was in early 2000, I was surfing a bunch as well. And I would watch what you guys are doing. And there's like this mythical, not mythical, it's a party line, I guess. Under, let's call it 12-foot face, it's fun. There's some, you know, like it's on, right? Like the double overhead. And you got to really, at least me, I have to really kind of compose myself to drop into those waves. But then over that, when it starts getting like 15, 16-foot faces, I don't have that skill. Like that thing is terrifying for me to feel comfortable. And then when I'm watching you guys surf 50+, and it's a wave of consequence, not just because of the amount of water, but because of the throat of the wave.
Yeah.
And I remember in the 90s seeing waves, these mythical monsters that are out there, and the purveying thought was you can't get enough speed to come into, to drop into the wave, because the way the water going up the wave is too great for the speed that the surfboard needs to go down the wave.
And the arms.
And the arms couldn't generate enough momentum.
And then if you did, you have a good chance of dying.
Because you get pitched, right? Like right on top of it. So like you've been on this scene for a long time. Why did you go from the 20-foot plus into the 50+? And then your record holds it. Is it 100 or 80?
78. Why did I make the jump? It was just a progression of what I've enjoyed. And I was always looking for the rush mainly. Always every wave. And I was not comfortable at certain levels. And I had to go out and get comfortable. And I got, when I wasn't comfortable, that's when I got the rush.
Okay. Talk, let's pull on that thread for just a little bit. Those spaces that you are not uncomfortable, you would go look for them.
I don't know. I wouldn't really look for them, but they were there. And I would just, so it's weird because the North Shore got so crowded and tow surfing started. I saw Laird and Buzzy and Derek the first day they did it at a backyards, and I ran home and got my gun to paddle out to ask them to tow me into one, but I just stood on the beach. I mean, literally, you can visualize that cartoon character where his jaw drops on the ground and he just stuck, yeah, just in awe and didn't paddle out. But then from that day, I was like, oh, I got to get a boat. They did it with a boat. They didn't use jet skis. So I got a boat. I got a big black Zodiac, painted a big shark mouth on the front. We started towing with that thing, but then the propeller would come by and like, ah. So then they introduced the personal watercrafts, the wave runners, and then it was on. Yeah, it was amazing.
Okay. How do you get better at being uncomfortable? Like, what have you learned? Because you spent a lot of time in very uncomfortable experiences.
You know what? A lot of it was God. My sense of security in God definitely made me kind of fearless. But then after so many big wave sessions and so many wipeouts and so many locations, and then after surfing the glaciers in Alaska, the fear disappeared. Like it literally disappeared. I could not get the rush anymore. And the only time I would get the rush is if I was afraid. I would never get the rush. You know, there's the endorphins and the dopamine. I would get which one's the heavier, quick one? The dopamine, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Both of them happen, but dopamine's a feel-good chemical.
Just like boom.
That's adrenaline. Adrenaline is like, it's on. Like, yeah. 0 to 2 seconds, yes. My heart's thumping.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't get that anymore, no matter what was going on.
So you probably had adrenal fatigue or adrenal burnout, like combat. Folks that are in the amphitheater of war can oftentimes come back totally burn out from such high levels of chronic stress. And so you might have had some fatigue in there. But hold on, before we go there, because this isn't really important. You said God. What does that mean that God to you? What does that mean that?
Well, I was a full-on born-again Christian. And I was going to heaven and nothing was going to go wrong. It didn't, but that wasn't supposed to happen.
Okay. So, so your model was that if I die out here, this is how it's supposed to happen.
No, before I had kids, that was before I had kids and I didn't really care if I died because I was having so much fun. It was my passion. Once I had kids, I was not going to die. And I knew that. And I made sure I had it trained properly and was always ready. And I got a really good relationship with my gut, and I know when things are going to go wrong. I can sense things in the future and what's going to happen, how they're going to happen, and I pay good attention to it and listen to it. And there was like a couple of times I threw in a towel, one tile and time in particular that I threw in the towel, and it was a perfect day at Jaws, and just nothing felt right. And my partner put me on a wave. It didn't feel right. And then I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to drive today. And it was not very, not normal for me at all, but I knew something wasn't right and didn't surf that day.
Mm. So most of the times you would feel safe enough when you would listen to your gut, it wouldn't send the signals that you should leave. It would send signals that this is dangerous, but you have the skills.
It would send me signals to go deeper.
Go deep. Go
that's,
bigger.
That's it. Just get as deep as you can and put it all on the line for the ultimate ride, because that's going to give you the rush.
So it was about the rush. You were a thrill seeker at that.
I also put food on the table. You get to get contract signed every year.
If you go deeper. Yeah. If you get the picture.
If you get the wave of the day.
That's right.
And it was a lot of ego, a lot of... But it was very satisfying in the moment, and as the awards or the, you know, the ads or the movies or whatever, you got this. All right, you're gonna get paid again. You're gonna get paid again.
Okay. Yeah.
The last time I didn't listen to my wife and my gut, I shattered my shoulder at Mavericks, and I was letting ego get a hold of me again, and I went to Mavericks with a sore neck, super hungry to get into the Mavs contest, which is unnecessary. I had Nazare. But it's so, you know, I've been surfing Nazare for 5 years straight, or maybe it was even up to, I think it was six at that point.
Mavericks is a big cold water wave in Northern California, and Nazare is in Portugal.
Yeah.
Right? And like a big, massive, we'll get to that in a minute, but a one of a kind type of experience. So you didn't listen to your gut.
Yeah, Nazare is a sandbar, so there's no channel, so you're never safe. And it is the biggest wave in the world. There's any year that Nazare doesn't win for biggest wave, it's politics, because it's 10 to 20 to 30 feet bigger, guarantee, no exaggeration, every single year. Kai Laney, I love Kai, but that wave at Jaws was peanuts compared to what came in at Nazare the year before, that same year. And it's the most challenging because it's never the same wave twice. Mavericks and Jaws both break in one spot. There's a beautiful channel. It's cutting. When you surf Nazare for 5 years straight, paddling and towing, you show up at Mavericks and you're a kid, and it's like so easy and so fun and so, it's like, it's too easy as a big wave surfer. And the first day back, it was the most crowded day ever. And I caught every single wave I wanted and had the time of my life. And everybody was like, they're all grumpy. And I was just having so much fun. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. So then I come back. I tried to catch this monster 60-foot wave from the first, from the deep bowl. And I was coming down it. And then it doubled up and stuck me out the back. And then the next swell, same exact thing. I was like deep. Way behind everybody's here, and I'm over here. And I tried to get them and don't make it in. So I'm like, I'm going to get a bigger board. I'm going to get a heavier board, and I'm going to go back there. I'm going to get that thing, get barreled on a 60-foot wave at Mavs. And I just got back from Nazareth. I'm in Hawaii. It was January. We got home for New Year's. We were there for New Year's. And I told myself, okay, if it's New Year's, I'm going to start doing yoga every single day, get my body. I was surfing so much that I was really strong, but I was stiff and sore. And I'm like, okay, I got to do yoga. January 1st, yoga. We went to a friend's party in town. It's mellow, nothing too out of control, but we drank a bit. And I got a hangover, and the next day I was hanging, and then I didn't do yoga, and I really didn't put the plan into place, and just kind of, you know, had fun and cruised. And then the Maverick Swell pops up, and I go, and my wife's saying, oh, she didn't really want me to go because she goes everywhere with me, and she couldn't go. And then my neck was sore, and my gut was kind of saying don't go, but my ego was saying gotta go. And everybody was going up to Oregon, so I was going to be at Mav pretty much alone. And when we went out there, we were alone. And I blew my inflation up a little extra, so I had this pillow to lay on while I'm paddling. Seriously, like a pillow, so my neck wouldn't hurt. And this one guy, Pato, a really good friend of mine from Brazil, he was there. So me and Pato, I said, come on, Pato, let's go. He said, okay. And we went out, and we jump off the skis to paddle over, and we paddle super deep, right where I want to be. He's like, Garrett, we're really deep. I'm like, yes, that's where I want to be. Boom, the wave just comes in 1 second, straight to me. I just, and I'm just so.
Wait. What is that like to see 50 feet of water pop up in front of you? It's black.
It's exciting. Super fun.
This is where you and I are different, because I get incredibly. I'm terrified when I see something over my
comfort zone.
Yeah, right. And it doesn't mean I'm not going to do it, but this is where all of the safety mechanisms inside of me say, hey, no. And it's probably a demonstration of, like, I don't have the skill that you have, which makes perfect sense. But you're operating at a different level.
And where's your spot? Where do you like to surf?
Oh, I right up the coast here. In Palos Verdes, there's some beautiful waves, and
I think it's pretty big there, right?
Yeah, there's a place called Indicator, and it's a nice, heavy, boily type drop. It's moderately consequence because of the terrain, and like I said, 12, 15 feet is like I'm in that place where I'm like, wow.
Okay. What kind of board?
Let's call it 6'3", 6. Nah, it's more like a 6'0" now.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. Seem too small for you.
Yeah, I've graduated.
Yeah, you're staying with the big stuff.
I went 10-6 about, I don't know, 10 years ago. Yeah, I mean, just because of the eddy.
Yeah, well,
we're just solely focusing on the eddy.
But our skill sets are very different. And so
it was either 6-0 or 10-6. 6-0 toe board
for
10,
you.
6,
yeah,
paddle.
Right. Yeah. So, okay, how do you manage fear? And I don't know if you said I couldn't get the fear anymore. And then, so you had to go bigger. And so to go bigger, let's play this game a little bit differently. When you're towing somebody and it's not your life on the line, it's your partner's life, that you got to go into a consequential place. He's just fallen and wiped out. And like, you don't want him to take another one on the head. Maybe do two things. Describe what it's like to be held under by one of these giants. And then what it's like to actually be responsible for someone's life.
That's when I have the most fun, is putting other people on waves. And I think it's because there's so much responsibility and you choose the right spot. You're in control of where they're going. I mean, they can signal a little bit and tell you a little bit to the shoulder, a little bit deeper, or number two. But once you let them go, or once they let go and they're coming down the wave, then you're their lifeline if they don't make it. Or in Nasri, no matter what's going on, you're the lifeline, because they kick out. You got to get them before that next one closes out on them. It's really, I love to just run to the shoulder and watch. It's even more fun when you can tow them at the wave and then ride under them and watch them surf from under the whole time. It's not the safest way.
So you're in front of the wave?
Yeah, because you can't get them as easy. You got to have somebody else out the back for backup. And that's the most, that's the best view in the house. Under one of your friends just ripping. Ah, it's like, it's just so beautiful. Yeah, their life's on the line of you rescuing them. We have such good safety equipment now with the inflation and the flotation. We started out with the flotation, then it turned into inflation. And we have the personal watercrafts, the wave runners on the outside. And sometimes you have two or three, one on the inside, one driving, and one extra one roaming. But when you let go and the wave closes out, or you pull in and get clamped, or for some reason in Nazare, you can just fall from the chops. And the chops are as big as waves, and you're flying over these chops. And then the jet ski wakes now. Almost every wave has a jet ski wake in it now. It's crazy. And so when you fall and you hit so hard, your initial hit is super hard already. I think most of us don't get the wind knocked out of us, but once in a while, when you hit, you get the wind knocked out of you. And then you got to take this monster that isn't a normal monster. It's more like an animal. All waves are like different animals. And Nazare is more than an animal. It's really just like an avalanche. It gains momentum. And just, it's relentless. And then if you're underwater getting pounded and you don't want to pull, and most of us use a little flotation. The smarter people do, at least, who want to live. The other people who don't care about dying don't. And you're just getting the first hit is the hard water, the bottom of the wave, and then the wave comes and hits you like a ton of bricks. I mean, it is so violent, and it first just crushes you. And then it spins you in every single direction, upside down and backwards and around and on the bottom and in circles, and just, and it kind of will let you go at times, and it'll take you again. And if you're in the foamy water and in the aerated water, the inflation and flotation don't work. It has to be hard water. So the wave has to pass. So you got to kind of get pushed out the back, and then you come up. But you can relax the whole time during all this violence. You can if you can choose to relax, you can relax. And then you just kind of come up with a couple of strokes, try to use the least amount of body movement, because with your legs, it takes a lot of oxygen. With your arms, it's better to just stroke really mellow and slow with your arms, calm. Hopefully you come up, and usually when you come up, you're so dizzy, you don't know which way is what, and you got to get to your senses. And then half the time, right when you get to your senses, either the guy will get you, or another one mows you over. And then you got to go through it all over again. And personal watercraft can get taken out or malfunction, or think you went left and you went right. And then you got to be on your own. And you're just getting pounded and pounded and pounded. And then when you finally get halfway to the beach, you think you're safe. All of a sudden, another 20-foot wave can just be more powerful than the 40-footer. And that one will land on you. And then when you finally get to the shoreline, it's the steepest beach. So it sucks you in, sucks you out, sucks you in, sucks you out. If you don't have flotation, you're not getting out of the water. If you have flotation, you can make it out of the water.
How many times have you been close to dying?
Never. Hmm. I really enjoy the underwater rides. That's when there's a chance of better chance of getting the rush because you're just at the mercy of the ocean and have no control. Just recently in Indonesia, I was probably the closest to potentially dying, but somebody told me they saw me where I was, so I wouldn't have died. They would have found me, but I hit the reef right here and
on your head.
And I pulled my board, and then I got on my board, and I was spinning, like all dizzy and trying to hold on the board, and I was almost knocked out. And my children and my wife flashed how important life is and how important they are. And I got to the beach, and I couldn't remember what camp I was staying in, and I couldn't remember where my wife was. I knew that she didn't come on the trip, but I was like, but where'd she go? And then
full concussion.
What camp am I? Yeah. Am I in Yo-Yo's camp or Bobby's camp? Where am I? I mean, I kind of knew where I was, and I knew that she wasn't with me, but I didn't know what camp I was in, and I didn't know where she actually was. And that went on for about an hour.
Yeah.
And they were kept filming it, and they said that I didn't see the footage, but they said that I was saying the same three or four questions over and over and over.
Yeah, full concussion. Yeah.
Full concussion.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I think about your model, and it's really, I wouldn't know how somebody, myself included, could begin to replicate how you've experienced life and how you experience risk. And, you know, I don't even know what the takeaway is, because it's so rare and so extraordinary. And the easy question that I have for you is, what do you hope people could learn from you?
Well, definitely everything is possible. It doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter how you started out. I mean, at one point I was eating out of trash cans. So don't let your past define you. It's history, does not exist. And plan for the future, but it doesn't exist either. You got to live now. And really the main tool that I know that everybody can utilize and that can help everybody live their dreams. Well, first of all, you figure out what you're passionate about. And it can be something that you love to do when you're three, or something that you think you're passionate about now that the world got a hold of you and molded you to however you got molded. Parents and social media and TV, and they mold us really, really well. So a lot of us don't even know what our real passion is anymore. Sometimes you got to go back to when you're three, what you love doing more than anything. And then make that your, make sure it's your passion. That is the goal. Like keep surfing. And figure out how to serve humanity in one way or another, through your passion. And then write the goal. Write the map. And focus. And be very careful what you write. Because if you write that and make the perfect map, a realistic map, a map that, and the goal has to be realistic. It doesn't really have to, but better if it is. And it will come true. It will flourish. It will work. You'll be doing what you love, and you'll be contributing to society, contributing to Mother Earth, contributing to the world. And you will feel good all day, every day. The best thing in the world is putting smiles on people's faces. When you see people smiling from something that you did with them or for them, it's the best feeling in the world. So I didn't write my first goal until I was 30. So it's never too early. Most kids out there, you guys can start now. And it also never too late. So never give up on your passion.
Troll's with us today, and Troll's a friend of mine. He's got. I know you've got questions. What questions? You're quietly listening for the most part.
One question I have is: you spend so much time with different kinds of people in different cultures and different experiences. What was it like for you in some of your early memories being alone, immersed in the powerful ocean for the first few times? And in that phase of your exploration with the ocean, did you ever run into consequence where you actually had to get rescued before you started to explore boundaries that eventually you just removed?
When I was 15, I hitchhiked or got a bus. I don't know. Somehow I got up to Sunset Point, and I paddled out to Sunset. And I took off. It wasn't hardly anybody out. And it was like, I think it was the dreaded 7. It's like 8 feet's good, and 6 feet and under is good, and 8 feet and over is good. But 7 feet's a little weird. And I took off on this wave, and just the board slid out. And it was only like a 12 or 15 foot face, and I got pounded beyond, and I vowed to never surf a wave over 10 feet. And I hung out with these two guys, Fielding and Jasper. They were like really good professional surfers at that time. And I was going to be like them. They were small wave pros. They didn't surf waves over 15 feet. And I was going to be just like them and very content and happy and never surf a big wave ever again. And having to get rescued, I've never really had to get rescued, but I've gladly take a ride on a ski anytime. I'd gladly get rescued or get help to the beach to go get my board. Or I was about 22, Waimea Bay, pretty much herniated my, I thought I broke my back, but they said I just herniated my disc, so it was way worse than breaking the bones. And as I was underwater, I could feel my heels touch my head, and all the wind knocked out, all the air knocked out of me, and I came up, and I couldn't speak, and I was seeing black and white. And this guy, Ace Cool, he's like this big wave,
with a name
very
like
interesting
that.
Yeah. Character. And he was paddling by and said, "You need help?" And I'm like, I couldn't say anything because I was like, couldn't talk. And he kept going. And then he's "No." He said, "You okay?" And I went, "No." Finally, he came out. And so he came and gave me his board, and I paddled, and he kind of pushed me in. But that was the one time I remember kind of getting rescued. I could have made it, but I was very happy to get some help.
You're incredibly resilient, resourceful. There's a sense of independence that somehow you've learned from being a pack animal, you know, from early days. And if people could come to live life according to what you've come to learn and to really embody, what would life be like for us?
If people could live life like me?
Yeah. Based on the principles that you've come to learn.
Oh. They would have a lot of freedom and fun, and it's really about letting the kids learn from experience and actually letting them do things that society tells us. They can't hold the knife. They can't go in the water and swim there. There's different things that are safe and other things that are not. So it's more freedom, more carefree, more, you'd get to feel a lot of freedom, which we don't have these days.
Hmm. How do you finish this thought? It all comes down to?
Well, we choose not to have these days. We have freedom if we choose it. And what was that?
Cool addition. Yeah. It all comes down to?
I don't know. You tell me.
Good response. I don't either. That's why I'm asking the question. You know,
it all comes down to following your heart. Let your heart guide you.
What do you do to strengthen your connection to your heart?
Ayahuasca.
Do you? Yeah. How often?
That actually worked pretty well. What do I do? Deepak Chopra, amazing. Fierce Medicine by Anna Forrest, amazing.
The yoga practice?
Yeah, but mm-hmm. She wrote a book.
Okay.
It's really good. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend it. Death Meditation. That will get you in touch with your heart.
And yeah, what's important. It really will.
There are some really good ceremonies out there these days, but you got to, I've done a couple and I was like, ugh. And I just met this one family that does the most amazing, beautiful experience and just really shares what's important. And it really opens your heart. But the, all these ceremony things that people are doing is cool. It's like the cool thing now. It's if you don't write down what you felt and learned and actually look at that every day, you're just going to go back to normal life and senseless. But if you actually integrate what you learn, you're going to have great results and you're going to be a very contributing person with be selfless and very desire. People very much desire having you around them.
Cool thought. Chronic stress is a real problem for people. You live in a highly acute stress environment with consequences. But chronic stress, that inability to manage the load, workload, whatever the load is on our mind and our brain, is a real deal for people. How would you hope people could better manage chronic stress?
I would recommend meditating every morning, and you do a minute. There's a really good one we've been working with lately, is you do your minute, 5 minutes, 10 minutes of think about every single thing you have to do for the day and for the rest of your life, and throw it all in there. And then think of, there's a 3 to 5 step process, but first just think about everything you got to do and then just kind of trying to meditate on it and then meditate on the breath. And the breath is really the only way to actually calm the mind down for me. If you just focus, and just say that while you're doing it in your mind. So I can't hold on to more than one thought. So if I do that, I'm good. I'm actually in the zone. Women, I think they can hold on to more than one thought. So I don't know. I don't have a solution for them.
Okay. How often are you in the zone? You talked about flow state in the zone. How often do you get there?
I can close my eyes and get there in a second. If I just really, when I close my eyes, I'm more in touch with my heart. When my eyes open, there's too much distraction. But if I close my eyes, I can feel my heart, feel my body, love myself, figure out how to share this great feeling with everybody. I definitely wear my heart on my sleeve, but the head gets in the way. If your head and your heart are fighting, it's really chaos. And if you're following your heart, everything else is perfect. And recently somebody was sharing with me, I'm like, there's all these injustices, there's crazy things going on in all the third world countries that isn't. And I've always thought that everything happened for a reason and there's a greater something for some reason. But there is, I was like, there's things that are going on in these third world countries. There's no way that they could be happening for a reason. And I just like thought to myself, okay, if what's happening was coming from a heartfelt decision, a decision from the heart, then I would say, yes, it happened for a reason. But if what's happening to somebody or a whole country or the world, Mother Earth, stemming from greed, it is not happening for a reason.
What are you most concerned about as a man in your, 40s, 50s? What are you most concerned about?
The most is just since my shoulder pain, no health, being really healthy and being able to continue doing everything. And I know that for me, yoga is the answer and meditating. And, I love strength and conditioning. I love going to it's not CrossFit, but it's, functional fitness with my good group of guys in Hawaii, Kai Borg and the boys and Holly Eva, and it was so much fun, such good support. And it's not a lot of ego. I mean, you can bring your ego in if you want, but they're not pushing for that. And so it's a beautiful environment to get stronger. But yoga really seems to be the key, because the flexibility and holding the poses and actually tensing your muscles, but also relaxing. So it's strength and flexibility yoga. Force yoga is the best. As you sit in these poses as long as you can. And anytime you're going into a dull pain, stay there till it goes away. Sharp pain, stay away. Dull pain is just garbage that we're holding on to.
Let me flip that on the psychology side. At any given moment in time, I can find myself in a standing civil war within myself, arguing, battling sometimes. It's not my highest self. It's not, you know, but it is part of it, my experience. Do you relate to that at all?
Definitely.
And what do you do when you've got that tension? You use it from head and heart, or maybe it's an argument with yourself, like, man, what are you doing with your life? Or it's something more benign and small, which is like, hey, you don't have what it takes to be able to actually do these goals, or something like that. Some guilt, some shame, some critique that you work through. How do you do it?
Close your eyes and go, is this loving, kind, or helpful to me and everybody my choices affect?
You're an extraordinary human. I don't know anyone like you.
I'm not saying I'm the best at this, but that's what I go
through.
Right.
That's
your go-to. That's my go-to there. And
did mom teach you that? Did the commune teach you that? Did something later? Did the ocean?
Mama ayahuasca.
And when you say that.
Seriously.
Okay. So are you talking about drugs, or are you talking about.
It's medicine. It's not drugs.
So ayahuasca is something that you've flirted with, or you use on a regular basis?
No, I went to become more in, to feel more. We're not feeling anything these days. We're on autopilot. We just follow this guy, the motherfucker.
The mind.
And you got to follow this. And it helps you.
The heart.
Yeah.
Are you a compassionate human? Meaning that you live with great empathy and compassion? Or are you a physical human?
Great passion and compassion. I'm working on the empathy.
You're working on empathy.
Definitely. I think my greatest quality, that I'm really always willing to work on being a better person. And I think that's what the main reason my wife's still with me.
What is mastery to you? How do you define, think about, articulate mastery?
Mastery?
Yeah.
Oh, it's when you're, they say 10,000 hours, 4 hours a day for 10 years, you become a master at anything. And I have to agree with that. Once you do something so much with so much dedication and passion, you'll become a master. But to be a master for me is to be, I think you're a master when you realize you know nothing. And you're always willing to learn more and experience more. And to be at peace and happy all day, that's when you're a master. And that is very challenging. And, you know, you close your eyes, go to your heart, and feel what's right and what's how you can be of service and what you love and how to love yourself and love everybody around you. That's when you're really a master.
God, I want to be around you more often. I swear.
But again, I'm not that good at it. I'm still working on it.
Garrett, I'm so happy to have met you. And I think we were all over the shop in our conversation. And so I apologize if I've done a disservice to your genius, but I'm fascinated by so many different ways that you've experienced life. And I think the framework of the experience of your life are essential to understand the insights you have. You are unconventional in the way that you've lived, and you're unconventional in the way that you think. And I love the essence of how you approach life, the humility, the excellence that you are able to demonstrate by surfing the biggest waves in the world and holding records and being responsible for other men's lives that you're towing in. And at the same time, it's all so delicate. You know, you're not like thumping your chest and rah, rah. Maybe there's some of that, but it didn't come out today. And it feels like at any given point in time, the whole thing could kind of fall apart. And I love all of that. And I love that because it makes sense to me. It's not, there's no bulletproof, ironclad, this is how it is. It's like the surrendering of to the fragility of life and having the internal fortitude and strength to manage the most difficult part of life, which is the heart. Not being held under by one of the largest forces in the world. It's the heart.
Yeah, they've all been talking about the 100-foot wave, and I'm just like, all day, every day, life is the 100-foot wave. There used to be the 10-second barrel, and you just focus on being in the 10-second barrel wherever you go. But now it's the 100-foot wave.
Amazing. Okay. Garrett, where can people find you? Where can people follow along with your worldview and the fun stuff that you're doing and the deep stuff you're doing?
On Instagram, we do our best to post things that are meaningful and actually do some good with the platform, showcase other people and what they're doing and share what we're doing. And we just started I don't want to call it a vlog, more of episodes. We started shooting some episodes and we put the first one out there. But we're not going to really launch it until like I have 4 or 5 or so. That'll be a cool place. Garrett McNamara YouTube, I think. What is it, Benny? Is that what it is? Okay. I don't know anything about all that stuff. I just try to.
We'll put it on the show notes with all the right links. Yeah. We'll put it all so people can access it. And, you know, our community of people who are thirsty, hungry, they're really trying to understand how to be better. If you gave them one little parting gem, what would it be?
Do a 1-minute meditation because it's easy. We can all do that. And focus on, get a mantra of how you want to be all day, every day, and just meditate on that mantra. And then it's hard to keep it going all day long. It's good to do a 1 minute 3 times a day. And if you want to go 10 or an hour or whatever, that's fine and that's great. But if you do the 1 minute, you're already working towards being a better person because you're setting the intention and digesting it and saying it to yourself over and over, how you want to be, how you want to contribute, how you want to be thought, how you want to be seen. And we all just want to be loved. So love is the answer.
Thank you. I mean, I'm like giddy. I've got a little shake inside of me, you know, like I just feel, I don't know if it's adrenaline or gratitude, but physiologically you've changed me and I appreciate you. Thank you.
Well, I've never had so much fun and usually I go all different directions, so it was perfect.
Wait a minute. Hold on now. This conversation, I'm sure you've had more fun than this conversation.
Seriously, in this kind of environment. Yeah, but sharing this stuff is super important and beautiful. And
yeah.
Thank you. This is really fun. This is the 100-foot wave right here today.
This is it for me too.
Yeah, 100-foot wave podcast.
Yeah. Appreciate you, Garrett.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show.
If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.